Good morning. This is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the May 11th, 2022 meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. This meeting is also being conducted telephonically to provide further access by the public. DJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this meeting.
Good morning. This is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for the Credit Committee, Board of Commissioners, and specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask the commissioners and participating staff to please mute your telephones if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. This is Carol Ventura. Corinne Myers, General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide additional information on this meeting.
Good morning. This is Corinne Myers speaking. Members of the public can visit the RN Housing website to view today's agenda and information on the actions being taken. If the teleconference portion is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio is restored. Chairman of the Credit Committee, Kevin Borst, will preside at today's meeting. Commissioners and staff, when you speak during the meeting, please state your name prior to speaking. With that, I will turn it over to Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order.
Hello, this is Commissioner Orth. I'd like to call a meeting to order now. And would you please give that roll call?
Certainly.
Better?
Certainly. Thank you, Commissioner Orth. Commissioner Kevin Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Luke Tanner.
Here.
Commissioner Maria Barry.
Here.
Roll call is complete. You have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Now I'd like to introduce committee action item number one, which is the approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on March 9, 2022. Request a motion to approve.
So moved. Liz Tanner.
Thank you.
Liz. Second.
Thank you, Maria. First, it's in, motion has been made and seconded. And any discussion on minutes? Nope. Great. Corinne, would you please conduct a roll call vote? Motion.
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of recommending approval of the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on March 9, 2022, please say aye, and if you are opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
Commissioner Barry?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Corinne. Now I'd like to move on to committee action item number two, which is a recommendation for preliminary approval of financing for Vernon Mills located in Woonsocket. I'd like to introduce St. Jean, Real Estate Development Officer, who will present this action item.
Good morning. This is Seth St. Jean speaking. The project is Vernon Mills and the developer is Breeze Adventure, LLC. The request is for a preliminary commitment of a tax-exempt construction loan totaling $11.56 million, of which $2.16 million remain as the permanent first mortgage. Vernon Mills is located in Woonsocket. It is a proposed 60-unit historical mill redevelopment consisting of 3 buildings. Prior to Breeze's involvement, there were several redevelopment attempts to rehabilitate the property. One building was partially redeveloped but was never completed, and 2 of the other buildings in the project are in very poor condition and continue to deteriorate. The preliminary construction budget is approximately $14.9 million, or $240,000 per unit, and total development cost is approximately $24.77 million, or $413,000 per unit. Backing out the reserves, the project remains just below the per-unit QAP cap of $390,000 per unit. The project previously received $4 million in BHRI funding and has applied under the most recent consolidated RFP. The syndicator is Alliant Capital and is projecting 94 cents per credit. Of the 60 units, there will be a mix of efficiency, 1- and 2-bedroom units, at various income AMI levels up to 80%. The developer has applied for project-based vouchers from the City of Woonsocket and 811 vouchers from Rhode Island Housing. The project conforms with Rhode Island Housing underwriting standards with the exception of the bridge loan test, but the bridge loan, the tax exempt loan is the minimum required to meet the 50% bond test to generate the 4% tax credits. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Liz, thank you very much, Seth. Liz, any questions?
Do you know if the investors are identified from
it sounds like most likely Bank of America.
Okay. I mean, do you know about that?
And we're thrilled that you're paying 94 cents.
Yeah.
I thought it could be us, so I just wanted to.
Do you have a history with this?
I believe we have done some work in New York.
Okay.
With the developer and continue to. So I don't think we've done anything outside New York.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
That was my question. Do they have experience in New York and other places?
Yeah, New York, various states. You know, New York, I think, was one of them. I'm blanking on some of the others, but if you want to know the other states, I can send that along after.
Have they ever done a mill conversion, do you know?
I don't think they've done a mill conversion, no. And, you know, they're really trying to get a footprint in Rhode Island. So I think this is their plan is for, you know, this to be the first of many projects in Rhode Island moving forward.
And this is Ann. The only thing I would add to your question is the principal of BRISA actually used to work for Alliance, right? So they have a very long, you know, he's been involved in projects across the country. Presumably some of them were mill rehabs. But Alliance is actually also part of the development entity, so.
But they're not the syndicator?
They are also the syndicator.
I'm sorry, I thought
it was
Bank of America.
Alliance is the investor. Bank of America. I'm sorry.
Alliance is the
Bank of America is the investor. Alliance Capital is the syndicator.
Oh, got it.
Yep.
Got it. Okay.
Which I think is good when Alliance involves, just provides additional.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the numbers of this. So it's a $25 million development. So if you take the NOI, you put a 5 cap on it, it has a value of about $3.7 million. So it's not what I would call an economic deal. They're in it for the credits. And it doesn't give the developer much incentive to stay in this deal if it goes south, especially one that doesn't have a relationship, I think, with us or have, you know, any other motive, perhaps. So I think this deal really hinges on the strength of the developer entity and also the hooks that we put into the entire investment partnership if something were to go south. So I see that it's only 15% installment up front, and we're putting in a very large equity bridge. So I'm wondering what the equity pay-in schedule would be on this. And what I'd like to see is that there's equity coming in throughout the construction, given what I see as a huge risk.
I don't know if we've, since this is preliminary, we'll certainly take a look at that through,
okay.
You know, as we get the final updated numbers.
Okay. I just to let you know, I think I would have that as a condition to when this comes for firm. I would have to see that, otherwise I wouldn't approve it. I wouldn't approve something with just a 15% upfront and nothing until the end. And then I guess my other comment is about this deviation from standard underwriting. This seems to be just becomes the standard response. It fails this part two. The fact that it is needed to meet the 50% test in my mind is not a justification for failure of part of the second test. What I'd like to see, not just on this but all these other deals, is okay, failed the part two. So what are we going to do about it? What mitigation is in place? And that's what I'd like to see. Hopefully you thought about it. I'd just like to see that it's stated in here, whether it's higher upfront pay-ins or whether it's heavier pay-ins, you know, throughout the construction process or personal guarantees from the developer, you know, whatever it is.
We always get personal guarantees from the developer. I would say that one of the challenges to the pay-in during construction, and I know you know this, is it impacts the pricing. So we try and balance both. I will note that because in these typically in these deals, the bonds have to be out for a certain period of time. So a good chunk of the repayment also comes from the soft debt that we're holding, and we won't inject into the deal until it's done. But we hear you. And we recognize that we'll do the best we can. Again, we don't, 94 cents is a pretty good price. There's also both federal historic and state historic that will be coming in as well. We are bridging that as well.
Right.
So
I think if you took that into account, if we're bridging the historic as well as the low income, it might actually meet the second test.
Well, I think it's a timing, right? So the historic will come in later in the deal. So I think if it were to come in earlier, it would help it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
take a look at that. I mean, other states, they would never do this, and they would require a lot more money up front, maybe even a fee for waiver of getting installments up front. So I see that you're being exceedingly flexible in order to make this deal happen, but I just to give you a little perspective. Mm-hmm. And also, this is a complex project. I mean, a mill conversion, we've seen just so many failures, I guess, that I'm not saying they're going to. They seem to have a great team in place. But I just want to be a little bit more cautious. This one gives me pause.
For what it's worth, I think Seth has been working on this since the day he walked into his office 8 months ago, and we're just getting to preliminary now. So we have some of the same concerns. The price has come down significantly. He has pared back the project. So I think it's worth noting that we have spent a long time working with the developers to get to something that we think is realistic before we've brought it to you.
Okay.
So we have thought about it, and we do have a long track record with mills, and dare I say it,
that's not wood, please. Please.
We do have mills too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've had a lot of success with mill conversions. It's just part of our real estate in Rhode Island, so it's an advantage we have.
Them, but,
yeah.
But they've got to be amongst the riskier of development.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
The highest, probably, record of failure. So it'd be wonderful to see it. And it looks like Woonsocket's throwing some money to it, too, so I assume it's of importance to them as well.
Which is terrific, being affordable and
yeah.
being in pocket,
yeah.
They can see affordable housing, certainly.
Yeah, and I don't have a lot of specifics on the bank's view on this, but I have a feeling that the price is partially driven by the timing.
Yeah,
Of course.
Always.
So I think if we change that, that might be another.
I think it's a balance, though, right? It's a balance of security versus price.
Yeah.
And so there's got to be somewhere maybe in the closer to the middle of that spectrum.
I think we actually look at it more like the timing of the capital versus like a risk. I mean, we go through every deal like we don't, we want to make sure it's going to go well.
Right.
And
right.
Knock on wood, I'm good. Find some wood. So I think that part of it is really timing of capital more than risk mitigation would be my view. And so I think it's just a matter of, it sounds to me like this is tight, finding all the sources, and my guess is that's why they landed where you landed on the 15%. So I need to find another piece if you want to bring more equity in earlier.
Any other comments or? Okay. Ren, would you please?
I think we need a motion.
Oh, sorry. I skipped over that part. I'll second. Any other comments or questions? Hearing none. Please.
This is Corinne speaking. Commissioner, if you want to call your name, if you're in favor of recommending preliminary approval of financing for Vernon Mill located in Woonsocket, please say aye. If you are opposed, say nay. I note that Commissioner Barry has recused. Committee Chairman Orth?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
And the ayes have it. Motion carries.
Thank you very much, Corinne. Committee action item number 3 has been withdrawn from the agenda. Term, Corinne?
Yep.
Great. So we will move on to action item number 4, which
is the recommendation for firm approval of financing for 315 Park Avenue Apartments in Cranston. And I'd like to introduce Jeff Swanson, Senior Real Estate Development Officer, who will present this item.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner Orth. This is an additional property in the portfolio that's owned by the Providence Realty Investment, or PRI for short, as we've kind of known around the office. This is a relatively straightforward refinance that includes an equity takeout. This morning, we are requesting approval of a new first mortgage not to exceed $10.1 million. The proposed source of funds for this first mortgage will be the FFB program, and the projected equity takeout is approximately $4.4 million. This is a 71-unit age-restricted property that has recently secured a new 20-year HAP contract. Post-closing, the borrower will complete a relatively modest scope of work totaling approximately $337,000. This work consists primarily of elevator upgrades and a roof replacement. In the past 6 months, management has completed an additional $75,000 of minor repairs that were deemed in the critical category in the CNA report. To ensure the property is well positioned for future capital projects, the initial deposit to the replacement reserve will be almost $7,500 per unit versus our minimum of $2,000 per unit. They will also make annual contribution to the replacement reserves of $400 a unit, whereas our minimum underwriting is $300. Underwriting conforms to Rhode Island Housing Standard requirements, except for the vacancy rate. A minimum of 5% is our typical minimum, but given the HAP contract and the historic vacancy at this property, staff believes 4% is appropriate.
Great. Thank you very much, Jeff. I'd like to ask for a motion to recommend approval of committee action item number 5. Thank you, Maria.
Stand in second.
Thank you, Liz. Any comments or questions about this one? I'll throw one out there. Since this is going FFB, this one's in our portfolio now, the loan?
It is.
And is there a, I forget what we came to about the prepay fee on these transactions?
Yep, there is one. It's $151,500.
And how is that calculated?
It's 1.5% of the total loan.
Of the new loan. Okay. And Kara is not here, but is there any kind of breakage fee? I know this is a tax exempt loan. Was it originally?
So yes, this is a tax exempt loan. It was actually. This is where history comes in. This was an NIBP loan. So this was a deal that was refinanced at the end of, in around 2010. I thought I heard somebody over the phone.
I did too.
We work with finance on all of these refinances, and the size of the new loan is large enough that it mitigates a prepayment fee on the breakage of the old loan. And Kara's on, she can kind of give you more detail if you need.
Kara, any comments on this?
Yes, this is Kara. I would just say on the bond side, the particular bonds that this loan was financed with had a 10-year lockout. We structured them so that we would be able to call out the bonds if these loans refinanced at year 15.
Is there much of a fee to us for prepaying those?
No, there is not.
Okay. Thank you, Kara.
Do we feel like that's enough in that account? Not per unit.
The replacement initial funding of $7,500 per unit?
Yeah. Do we think it's enough?
The short answer is yes. We have a CNA performed on all of these properties. they've taken a little bit of an atypical route. We have many folks who perform, you know, as you've all seen, you know, several million dollars it kind of shortly after closing, and they fund lesser reserves. These folks, the buildings really are in good shape, and so rather than fund kind of the minimum of $2,000 and do a lot of work up front, as we all know, it's a bit of a difficult time to do work, and there's many building components in these projects that have not reached the end of their useful life. So by setting aside a higher than typical replacement reserve as well as the higher annual contribution, we think that the reserves will be more than adequate to handle roof replacements, you know, parking lot replacements, things like that. They also are a little atypical in that where we see a lot of other developers do kitchens and bathrooms in large chunks with periodic refinances. These guys have a program where they, depending on the size of the property, do 5, 15 to 20 a year so that they're always kind of on a rolling basis. Both approaches work financially. They just take a slightly different path. But yes, we're quite confident that the properties are both in good shape now and will sufficiently capitalize down the road.
Okay, good. Thank you. I think that's such an important part of these projects. You know, it's just once they start falling apart, it just doesn't look back. So I think the fact that they're meeting it well and feel like they've got enough in there is.
In addition, this is Anne. In addition, we require for these deals in the loan agreement that they perform a CNA no later than year 10, and that gives us the opportunity to resize the deposit.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. Hearing no other questions or comments, Corinne, would you please conduct roll call vote?
Certainly. Commissioners, when I call your name, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of financing for 315 Park Avenue Apartments located in Cranston, please say aye. If you're opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orr?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
Commissioner Barry?
Aye.
The motion carries with a unanimous vote.
Great. Thank you very much. Now I'd like to move on to item number 5, which is the recommendation for firm approval of financing for Metcalf Courts 2, and again, we'll introduce this item for us.
Thank you. This is Jeff Swanson. Metcalf Courts 2 Apartments is a project in Providence. It's also part of the PRI portfolio. Similar to the last deal, this is a refinance with an equity takeout. We are requesting approval of a new first mortgage not to exceed $20,600,000, as well as a capital magnet fund loan of $100,000. These two loans will both be amortizing and at the same terms. The proposed source for the first mortgage is also the FFB program, and there's a projected equity takeout of $11.4 million. In total, this is 148 units of an age-restricted property. They also have a new 20-year HAP contract. The post-closing scope of work for this property is approximately $50,000, which is primarily envelope repairs and replacements. They've completed $60,000 of critical items that were identified in this CNA report. And then to ensure that the property has adequate funding for future capital projects, the initial funding to the replacement reserve will be $8,000, and they will make $500 per year contributions per unit on an annual basis. This project also conforms to standard underwriting except for the 5% versus 4% vacancy rate, which again, we believe is appropriate. For both of these projects, they've been at under 2 for quite a few years.
Great, thank you very much, Steph. I have a motion to approve action item number 5, which is approval of financing for Metcalf Courts 2.
Ms. Anderson, move.
Thank you, Liz.
Second, Maria Berry.
Thank you, Maria. Any comments or questions? This one? I'll throw up. There's a $100,000 capital magnet fund shown as a source. What's the justification for that?
Sure, I can answer that. This is Anne. As you know, we received a capital magnet. We've received three capital magnet grants, which is terrific. The grant requires that a certain number of units be in what they call areas of economic distress, which are similar to QCTs, but not exactly the same. And this building has 140 units that are in the AED, and it basically allows us to meet and exceed the requirements of the grant, and so that grant will now be closed out. It's a small amount of money, gets us a lot of units. It's, we've talked about this before, allows us to you know, use sort of larger amounts of gap funding for smaller projects that you know, really probably you know, as a 4% deal, have larger gap needs than this one because this has a Section 8 contract. So it helps us with those projects that don't have the full Section 8 contract.
Okay, so by putting a small amount of money in this deal, it'll allow us to put a larger amount of money into other deals that really need it.
Yes.
Okay. Could we, it, I mean, they're getting a $11 million cash out. Can we put this somewhere else?
We
no, no. I don't. I mean, given the metrics of the grant, which is a $5.5 million grant, it's the AED requirement on this particular grant was well over 75%. So it was a real challenge for us to get here. Typically, I would say that the capital magnet funds are deferred loans. They have an interest rate of 0.1%. This will have a 5.5% interest rate, and will come back to us, so we'll have some program income.
Okay.
We'll be able to do loans.
Okay. So it's a safe investment.
Absolutely.
Get the money back.
It's
a small amount.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It'll be fully amortizing and repaid, just like the principal of the first mortgage.
Okay. And just one formatic item, I guess, and I noticed this maybe on a couple of write-ups. Down under the loan-to-value test, I'm wondering if that section labeled appraisal is actually mislabeled and should be current underwriting? Because the narrative below makes it sound like our underwriting was a little more conservative than the appraisers, but yet the appraisers value are not lower than
I know. No, those are properly labeled. These deals, this is Jeff Swanson. As we've talked about in the past, these deals are kind of living, breathing things. When the appraisal was commissioned, they were still in year kind of one of the HAP contract. And we received the appraisal and completed our underwriting, and that's the reflective of the NOI that's for the appraisal column. You'll notice that the NOI in the underwriting column is quite a bit higher, and that was because as we were prepared to move forward to commitment, we're approaching year two, the one-year anniversary, and so they've received an OCAF rent adjustment, and that's firmly in place by the time we close, but that allowed us to underwrite to slightly higher income.
Thank you.
No other questions.
Okay.
Roll call vote.
Yes, this is Corinne speaking. When I call your name, if you're in favor of recommending firm approval of financing for Metcalf Ports 2 apartments in Providence, please say aye. If you're opposed, say nay. Committee Chairman Orr?
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner?
Aye.
And Commissioner Berry?
Aye.
The motion carries with the unanimous vote.
Thank you very much. That concludes our agenda items. You've been very patient. Thank you very much. Actually, 4 or 5 months patient.
Yeah. I think you have the pipeline report first before me, according to your agenda.
I will make this very short.
Okay.
I just want to let you know that we did receive the staff is busy, they're even more busy now. We received the RFPs under the consolidated application. We received 52 applications for capital funding. We have about $55 million to allocate. We received $217 million worth of requests, 2,680 units. So.
Oh, fantastic.
And we're trying really hard to bring some recommendations to the June.
Okay, great. That's really good to hear.
Not sure how happy, but, you know, we're happy.
Was there any feedback from the on the use of the that?
The one stop?
Yeah.
Yes. Definitely, I think folks appreciated it. There are definitely a few kinks we need to work out, but IT has been great. They've been really receptive, and we're working on sort of the next version of it.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Brenda, thank you very much again.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I know you all are very familiar with the fact book and how it works as well, too, but I never want to miss an opportunity to talk both about the fact book, but also just to talk and check in with our colleagues here at Rhode Island Housing. And a few things, once I just go through this quickly, just to remind you of the numbers, just a few kind of comments or questions or other things that I just wanted to talk to you about. But part of what we use the FastBook for is, you know, obviously sharing the data and the information, but also trying to reach out to kind of the usual and the unusual suspects, right? So we've been spending a lot of time talking to colleagues in healthcare and education and other fields where we know housing or the lack thereof has a tremendous impact on their quality and outcome. And really that is the genesis of Housing Works to begin with as part of the bond campaign to kind of show that connectedness or connect the dots between both economic growth and development, but also improving health and education outcomes. So I'm just going to, I think you have the PowerPoint in front of you printed out, so I'm just going to run through a few of the numbers again, many of which you know, and a few I just want to highlight again just for further discussion about, you know, what are we going to do about these, because some of these numbers are persistent problems, as we know. We all know the median income issues. We know the gap is huge. It's the first time ever since we've been publishing the fact book, though, that nobody could affordably buy in any community. That's the first time that's happened. So, you know, obviously that is a huge issue. We know home ownership is a critical wealth creation strategy for most middle income families. And, you know, literally, and then when you look at the next statistic, or I'm on the third slide now, looking at statewide housing indicators, the home ownership rate for Black and Latino home ownership rates has not budged since the late 1960s. And that is a crime, you know, that, and I know you've looked at some down payment closing cost assistance, we've looked at other things, but I think it's also time for us to, for those of us old enough to remember kind of some of the bank link programs and the other resources, we've got to look at how to creatively address this issue. We've got to look at how we can finance multifamily buildings and others that can open up more opportunities for homeownership, and we'd love to have some dialogue. I'd also encourage you to have a presentation from the board. A group at Brown has done a report with some funding from United Way about Black homeownership rates in the state. I don't know if any of you have seen that report as of yet, but the professor at Brown and others and Housing Works have been talking directly, but you know that may be a good topic of conversation, and they've got a number of policy recommendations in that report as well too, so I'd encourage us all to think hard about that. And then as we well know, Rhode Island has not only a quantity problem of housing at all income levels, you know, we see cost burden numbers at all income levels, but the most prominent obviously is at the very low income level as well too, and but we also have a quality issue, and the age of that housing stock, the rental housing stock in particular, is very old. We've got an aging population that wants to age in place and age in community, but the housing stock is a mismatch. And so thinking creatively, thinking differently about how we address those, how we create more multi-generational housing and options. The ADA review bill is up for a vote today in House Municipal Committee. We've been working closely with the Rhode Island Housing Government Relations Team and other housing advocates to get the work right. I will tell you there's two significant differences in the House version of the bill and the Senate version of the bill. And they've told us they're going to duke it out. So we'll see whether we get an ADU bill past this session, but we're closer than we've been for a long time. But again, I just wanted to point out about the quality of the housing as well, too. As I said, 23% of Rhode Island adults 65 and older have a disability and live in an older home, and most of that housing stock is not conducive to aging and living safely in that home. And then 73% of children under 5 live in older homes as well, too, and we know that even though we've done a good job around lead, we still have less than just about 10% of our housing stock is really considered lead safe. So a lot of the private market rental housing is still not safe necessarily for children under 5 and under 6 as well too. And again, and I'll come back to the unsheltered adults conversation, but we all know the impact that this last couple of years have had. We know the dilemmas that we continue to face on that front. But I do want to also point out that of the more than 11,000 jobs that were the Department of Labor and Training lists as the top high growth occupations, 72% of those do not pay enough to afford the current rent in Rhode Island as well too. And those are jobs that, just at the beginning of the pandemic were essential workers, and we were putting flags and signs out in front of their businesses and occupations saying they're providing critical resources to our community, and they are, except those are the people who, continue to struggle. They were struggling well before the pandemic, but the pandemic, has continued to hammer that point home. And so, again, looking at more options to kind of move people through a continuum. How do we move people? How do we create an IPA, individual development, kind of other programs where we can move people more into some economic security? I think it's part of the discussions that we need to have moving forward. So I'm moving on to just going through this fast, just want to, again, some of the data. As you know, the fact book is broken up with some statewide data, but then also regional data and also individual city and town pages. And our regional data pages, we're adding, already have started to add in, but also adding in a lot more about local land use and zoning in the 2022 version of that bill, with some work that we started with Rhode Island Housing around zoning ordinances and analysis of that, and then continuing to do some mapping and GIS mapping of that to include in the fact book. And we also are laying in the infrastructure, and so looking at municipal and water and sewer infrastructure in that. Right now, 17 municipalities, including Providence, the east side, allow for multifamily housing by right. Of the remaining 23 municipalities that do not allow it, 6 have infrastructure to support multifamily housing in the form of pretty much nearly full public water and sewer. And then a combination of 8 communities have full water and partial sewer, and 15 have partial water and sewer. And as we know, the technology, particularly around sewer, has really caught up. Town and local ordinances have not, and so there is still a huge barrier at the state level on that front. But again, I think this is another touch point where Rhode Island Housing and others can engage with other local partners and say, how can we target some of this infrastructure money and the federal infrastructure money to these communities, that you get bonus infrastructure money if you also start to meet towards your housing or come in with a housing plan or come in with a housing goal. And, obviously I know there are members of the administration here too, and we've been yapping to both the General Assembly and the administration about this, but it's the only way you're going to get local guys to do this. You've got to dangle money in front of them and got to make it worth their while. And so, but the infrastructure argument is really very much a misconception. There is infrastructure out there. They just don't want this development. So we've got to try to, work around the incentives or provide the right incentives to them to do that. So I'll come back to that. And then again, just to talk a little bit more about zoning, the state, no surprise, is overwhelmingly zoned single family development. There's only a very small fraction of residential zones that allow for two and multifamily development by right, and those often require large minimum lot zoning. Very few municipalities allow for appropriate zoning density around transit hubs. We've got some bills in the state houses here which may move. They'll definitely move in the Senate. It's still a crapshoot whether they'll move in that house at this point. And, even though their land use commission is meeting, the low mod commission is meeting, there isn't
likely to be significant zoning changes this session, not in an election year. So that's, you know, where we're kind of stuck on it, though, because we can't move forward. So that's why I think using your bullying pulpit here with the members of the administration to say you've got to tie this to the infrastructure money, you've got to, you know, make some requirements on this for communities to move forward while we continue to figure out how to do it. So just based on some of the work that we did in partnership with Rhode Island Housing, that I'm on Local Housing Facts Affordable Housing Strategies. This is just kind of a laundry list of some of the strategies that are listed in local plans, and local comprehensive plans, or their version of the local housing plan. And so I think, you know, this is what communities have said that they're willing to do. So let's meet them halfway. Let's figure out how to move forward on some of these thoughts and some of these recommendations. Obviously, ADUs are there, but, you know, can we match local trust funds? Can we do other things, you know, where we encourage development in village centers and communities? Can we kind of dangle some incentives in front of them as part of this as well, too? Can we help them identify empty lots for infill development? Can you develop a product, you know, that helps a developer come in to do some small infill development projects kind of on a revolving basis as well, too? So to me, you know, we're going to have to continue to battle at the local level, but if this is at least identified as some strategy, then we can say to them, hey, it's in your plan. And then when I'm on the State Housing Appeals Board, if they say, oh, no, we can't do this, it's in your plan, we're going to approve this project, then if you don't move forward, it gives us a little bit of leverage with those local communities as well, too. So again, love to have that conversation with you. Right now, only 25 of Rhode Island's 39 communities actually have a comprehensive plan approved by the state, and as you know, we do not technically have a statewide housing plan as well, too, and so I think particularly during this year, you know, election year and potentially transition year, now is the time for us to start working on this and get these pieces in place so that whoever is in the seat in the governor's office and the statewide offices post-November, we've got some action steps, we've got some things that we can start to implement immediately. And just continuing to try to figure out the structure. I'm looking at the complicated chart of the housing programs in Rhode Island. This is, we are working with Housing Network on a mapping project that we're just embarking on, but I say it all the time, there's no easy front door to access programs and resources and services. The one-stop application is a great first step on the development side, but it's also not a very consumer-friendly system. And as some of you know, I worked in Boston at CHAPA for about five, almost 6 years before returning back to Rhode Island. And CHAPA now has a very interesting housing navigator tool that we were starting on just as I was leaving. And again, like more consumer-friendly focus for searching for housing, not just affordable housing that's financed through Rhode Island Housing or other programs, but just kind of the private market financing housing as well, too. So again, these are things, you know, that I think we can work on regardless of, you know, what's going on politically around us as well, too. And as you can see, we continue to try to push on the gathering the building permit data, working with Ms. Chandler's office at ZBR, trying to get some of the e-permitting numbers. We're also trying to get the COs collected in a more easy fashion as well, too, because as you know, and as I say all the time at SHAP, I don't count it unless it's built. It doesn't count towards your number, or you don't get credit for it unless you can prove to me that it's built and somebody did it. But the building permit data is, you know, dismal at this point. We're well behind other communities as well, too, and so looking at ways to ramp that up and provide more incentives. Obviously, it's very tied to the zoning issues as well, too. So, and then, you know, again, we continue to be stuck at 6 out of 39 communities that are actually meeting that 10% goal, the low mod conditions, trying to look at ways to add some incentives to that community. Basically, a lot of the proposals right now are just different ways to count, which doesn't get us anywhere. You know, all we're doing is kind of allowing things that are already there so that communities can get more credit towards the account, but it's not creating new units. So
So that's a challenge, but you know, we'll see how it proceeds forward. It does look like we will have some ability to count the accessory dwelling units if that legislation does pass as well too. But and then the other places that I would point out on that 10% goal is this Princeton and West Warwick have the longest to go to achieve their 10% goal, and that's a big problem. You know, Princeton is the second largest city. They should be stepping up to the plate in a much bigger fashion than they are. Glad to see one project from Princeton was on your agenda today, but I think that's the first one in a long time. So building up some capacity there, building, you know, having some conversations with the city officials there. West Warwick, the same place. I mean, they're a little bit different of that area in of the state. Desperately needs more housing. Desperately needs more housing in a centralized hub that West Warwick could bring to the table. So looking at ways to provide incentives for developers, looking at using some of the acquisition money to buy up some property in those neighborhoods and those communities. That you can then RFP out for developers. You know, Cranston's got all the water and sewer stuff, and they should be stepping up. Warwick should be stepping up more too, but both Cranston and West Warwick have the furthest to go. And then finally, stop and happy to answer any questions, but just also want to talk about the homelessness issue and numbers on a couple of fronts. One is there's going to be another protest at the governor's office tomorrow around it. A lot of concern about the hotel voucher program leaving. I was at Amos House yesterday for the landlord challenge and kicked off last to see if there's some interest from landlords to participate in that program. That's great, but it's only going to give us, you know, maybe 100 units, you know, if that. And we need probably 6 times that amount. So, you know, and we talk a lot about winter shelter, and keeping people safe in the winter is important, but heat is just as dangerous as cold if you're living on the street. And so we've got to stop moving from these temporary solutions to more permanent housing. And if we get the buckets right at the State House and the legislature passes the money, we'll have some significant resources to do that. But in the short term, that's still going to take us a couple of years to build those. And so we've got to figure out something that's cheaper than hotels, because the hotel program is unbelievably costly. In Massachusetts, for years, has been funding a hotel program, as colleagues know, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars each year. And so, you know, can we acquire a building? Can we acquire? I know, and I'm not a fan completely of the PALET program as well, too, but you know, are those at least, can we experiment on the Cranston campus? Cranston needs to step up anyway. So can we experiment on the Cranston campus? There's plenty of room there. And I know Liz has been very involved in trying to find some sites, but you know, we've got to keep trying different things. And if it's, you know, if somebody's got a better idea, we've got to do it. But we've got, I mean, I'm really concerned. I mean, we've got to have a whole bunch more people out on the street corners again and in the campgrounds and no good alternative for them. So again, not this agency's complete problem, but you have a big piece of the problem, you know, a big piece of the solutions, or can be part of the solutions. And so I think we just have to start to experiment, start to try, use as much acquisition money as possible to start to get some properties under control. You know, we're not seeing a lot of outside investors yet in Winona, but they're starting to see them at some of the deals as well too. In other states, you know, bigger institutional funds and advancement are a much bigger problem already. But it's not far. It's already happening in Massachusetts, so it's not far from here yet either at this point. So anyway, and I just love to hear your thoughts about it, any of all of these subjects, but also just pushing hard at the General Assembly with other housing colleagues to. The governor has $250 in the budget. We think that's great, but we think it's a $1 billion problem or more. So we want to try to up that amount as much as possible. The recommendations from the housing groups were $500 million. I think it's unlikely based on the demand and all that money that we'll get that, but if we can move it up from $250. But we're also recommending that most of that money get put into acquisition and production funds you know, worry a little bit, use other funding and resources for some of the other things. So I'll stop there and happy to answer any questions. I threw a lot out at you of all my crazy mind working here.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of information. It was very well organized, I think, very, very much so.
Not my first rodeo.
No, you wrote it down very well.
comfortable during the housing bond campaigns when I'd have my vote yes on 7, but not, they'd say, oh, what's that? You know, 15 minutes later and their ice cream's melted.
45 minutes later.
They know more about housing than they ever really wanted to.
That's phenomenal. Any questions?
I have a question. So I saw the report that came out, I don't know, maybe 3 weeks ago, that said that Rhode Island had the lowest permit numbers. And it kind of made me laugh to say, I'm not sure where they're getting that data from, because
mm-hmm.
I think I'm the only person who gets the report that has the permit numbers, and even the report that I get isn't a very good one.
Yeah.
Do they actually call all 39 municipalities to try to get that information?
So I'm not sure which report you're talking about, but we call it all the 39 cities and towns, and so the data that you see in the chart is stuff that we do. Again, data quality is a huge, huge problem, and so our colleague Annette spends hours on the phone with folks, you know, saying, no, don't tell me which one's the new deck. I just want to know, you know, who is the actual unit. So, and she spends hours and hours trying to clean up that data. So I think you're talking about, it was a national report,
yeah.
And I think it's just census data that they're using, and that census data is correct. So. Or very unreliable, because it's a lot of apples and orange stuff in that data.
As a follow-up question, as far as the accessory dwelling unit registration, isn't there already a law that exists for them to register with municipalities?
So there is technically a law in the book that, are you talking about the landlord registry, or the accessory?
Well,
yeah, the bill was turned last night and sent it to judiciary, but so there is technically that if you're an out-of-state owner, you are technically supposed to register, I think it's in your office too, but I can't remember now.
At least I'm pretty sure, because I know they don't collect.
It might be in the municipalities. There is absolutely no teeth in it. There's no enforcement of it. And so the bill last night, you know, was to try to institute that with the more requirement and more penalties if you don't do it, and also just to make it more accessible for individuals. No surprise, the landlord's lobby is hugely against it. So the likelihood of it moving the session is not good. But it is, in an advocate's mind, kind of the precursor to a conversation around a certificate of habitability, where you have to register, and in order to rent a unit in the state, you have to show that you meet at least the minimum code standards. Very similar to a home inspection process on the state side. That's where we want to go, again, to address the deal, the quality of the issues. And so the registry is seen a little bit as an interim step.
Has your group done any research on that registration to see how poorly it is actually? Do people actually register? Is there any enforcement?
We have done a little bit, we being Housing Works, have done a little checking around. When we call municipalities, nobody knows what we're talking about. So that means that they're not doing it. So the attempt was to kind of put this under a state agency that would then say to, you know, issue rules and regulations and or say to communities, you have to send this by June 1st, you know, or whatever. And right now the current law has none of that. So there is, but there isn't, you know, currently.
Thank you.
But I think it's good business practice, right? I mean, you know, I mean, we regulate businesses all the time. If you're owning a multifamily property, whether it's 2 units or it's 22 units or it's 200 units, it's a business, right? And so as such, it needs to be regulated, and we need to know where those units are on a regular basis. So that's kind of the philosophy behind it. But landlords are like, no. So, well, let's find the common ground there. But anyway, so just curious to, again, as to curious as to your thoughts about the buckets of funding and money at the state level as well too. And Carol and I have talked a little bit about this already, but you know, are we right? Do you think it's the right emphasis to focus on the acquisition and production? And is there an appetite here to kind of create some new type of, or bring in different players to the table around acquisition? Can we buy kind of what would be untypical kind of properties for us to buy, like commercial buildings or, you know, vacant lots, we would, but, you know, other buildings that we might not normally look at for housing.
So I can say we're open to anything. I know we have a laundry list of developments that have come through the door, or parcels that have come through the door. We don't have the resources yet. I don't think we've received the resources from the state for the program yet, but we are proceeding.
A few loans.
Yeah.
We don't have the
resources yet, but we are moving along with site acquisition. And I agree, having a pool of property to develop at some future date is great, as long as you have the production resources to invest in those properties. So that's the challenge, right? What's that tipping point where you bought too much that you can't finance and it sits there as a blight in the community? So I think it's a balance.
I was struck that, and I don't know the regulations with Treasury on the use of these the ARPA funds, but it seemed that it was a once-in-a-generation opportunity.
It is.
Maybe to set up a permanent supportive housing fund, because we have the wherewithal to build the housing, but we don't really have the funds to you know provide for ongoing operation support.
The challenge is the timing. We have to get these funds to
Right, and we have to wait.
So you can't create, you can't establish a fund. You have to be ready to go, and you have to get these funds deployed and spent.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you lose them.
So,
right.
But Carol, the Treasury's approved investments into trust funds, though, right? For the ARPA funds, or at least they have in a couple of good states.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send you what I just saw on something too, because I mean that may be the model, right? You know, to put it. And you already have a trust fund, so I mean, you can use that and then dedicate that to kind of permanent supportive housing. I mean, tying it to the National Housing Trust Fund money would obviously get us down to that income level.
Yes, definitely.
There were some agreements with certain providers that I don't know if that would satisfy the use, you know, by a certain date.
I think it's always worth investigating if there are models across the country. Then,
I think it's Virginia, although you were talking about Virginia before, with one of the communities and somebody else. I'm going to
okay.
But it was apparently IRS approved or the Treasury approved it rather.
And in many ways, we can build this. I mean, we have developers that build supportive housing units all the time in the 9% deals. The challenge is how do you operate them,
right?
We don't have the vouchers. We don't have the operating resources. So when we receive the housing production fund dollars, we have two pots of money. One is production, and one is an operating subsidy similar to the Neighborhood Opportunities Program to support those units moving forward.
Yeah, if we had a endowed trust, we could make sure that we could build the units on an annual basis, and we had a pot of money to support them.
It's a persistent problem; it's never going to go away.
It's a crisis.
You know, we're short that 24,000 at the very low income level, but the supportive services are key in order to make that work as well too. The other flag, and I know you know staff here has done a great job with rent relief money in a very politically charged environment, but keeping funding and money moving out the door has been great. We do, you know, it was a challenging program right from day one. I will say anecdotally, I mean, obviously I'm concerned with the close down, particularly with the impact on some of the affordable developments. When I talked to some of the developers, over 60, 70, almost 75% in a few cases of their clients, of residents are receiving rental assistance. And so there's a bunch of people in the state rent for about 2 years now, and I'm really worried about that and really worried about attitude when that check no longer happens and what that's going to mean. And so just thinking about that and thinking about kind of, you know, can we be creative with IDAs and other, you know, to help people kind of do some creative funding and financing to help people kind of wean themselves off of rental relief, but also then trying to use this opportunity to help them create some more stability and assets. I mean, we knew well before the pandemic that very low-income people have less than $400 saved. You know, they cannot survive a crisis and a storm, and this last couple of years has shown us that, you know, without some significant relief. But now that, you know, if we're going to have a hard stop, we're going to have a cliff effect here with a lot of people, and we're going to have a lot, you know, eviction calendar is already chock full, but we're going to have more happening. But I'm also concerned about the stability of some of the developments. You know, we start to see some of that happen. So anyway, on that happy note, but just things to flag, things to just kind of continue to work our way through.
That was another item that I was hoping to see, was like some kind of eviction diversion program.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right, it is going to be a cliff. And then you're going to have a cast of kind of a musical chairs of tenants getting kicked out of one development, but going across the street to the other one, and that landlord can't ask, oh, why were you evicted? You know, they're going to have to accept them. I mean, it's just going to be a mess for a while. But then there's going to be a subset of residents that really need some help still.
Yeah.
And we don't have, we had $200 million or $220 now going down to zero.
Yeah.
So how do we, maybe we don't, we certainly don't need a $200 million program, but I don't know, $10 million or something.
Yeah. No, crises happen all the time. You know, people lose jobs, they get divorces, their kid gets sick, you know, and so we need that kind of ongoing rent relief program or version of the program in some way, shape, or form. You know, I don't think we can use any of the ARPA funds for that, but is there other mechanisms or other funding programs that we can do that to provide that cushion? But I am really worried about weaning, and I don't know if there is a way to use any of that rent relief money for kind of that, you know, step down approach to people, so that we don't, they don't lose, you know, they may lose 60%, then 50%, you know, and then we kind of take a 6-month process so they get back in, and more importantly, get back into getting used to paying rent, you know, because there's a lot of, I just know this personally for some properties that were, that I still manage for our church, you know, people are like, oh no, this is, I don't have to pay rent. I said, no, you do. I'm going to make my mother come and get it from you. And so I have my mother card, but not everybody does. But just something to worry about. But also knowing that these are really poor people who need some financial management skills, and they need, you know, some ability to have some way to save as well, too, to kind of let them weather themselves through the storms of life that always come.
Great.
Happy to work with you on these, not just stepping this on you and saying, good luck, figure it out. But, you know, we're always happy to serve as a resource and happy to work with you more. As Carol knows, your Richard Godfrey is now at Brad Williams University running the Real Estate Center and trying to coordinate between all of the programs. So it's been really fun to be working with Richard in his new capacity. And the Cummings family from Massachusetts just provided a $20 million grant gift endowment to the Real Estate Center. And so we're looking for more of that. And Richard Church was finding more money. But Redlands has some interesting possibilities. The law school, the construction management program, the community development program, also the community partner, and now Richard to try to weave together some of those resources. So I think a lot of us are also looking at kind of next gen leaders in the space as well too. I know I am. how to create a career path for this work in this field as well too. So stay tuned on that. And at some point in time, I'm sure Richard will be happy to come and talk more about this, Carol, as your schedule permits as well too. But there are some interesting possibilities. So.
Brenda, that's great. I just had a couple of quick things. I thought one of the comments you made in the beginning was really important about a holistic plan. Mm-hmm. And I know that Josh, I missed him in the last meeting, mm-hmm. but I did have a chance to catch up with him, and it sounds like he's really thinking hard about that. I think mm-hmm. that's great, because it just seems like the more global alignment
I agree. Yeah, I mean, you know, you got to have that plan and that vision, and then you more importantly have to implement it. I mean, as you know, the last time we attempted this was way back when with Roadmap and under the Chase, I think it was the Chase administration, and it got hugely derailed with all of the crazy rhetoric and the private ownership model of the group, which I think that's got to set it off down a path. And so it ultimately, you know, it became a political hot potato, and it dropped, and nobody's been willing to pick it up since then. But, you know, we've got to look at it. We've got to look at the land use. That we've got to look at where transit hubs make sense. You know, why aren't we building housing around closer to Quonset? Why aren't we building housing closer around the business parks and other things, you know, where job centers are? I mean, it's the village, it's the mill village model, right? I mean, it's Rhode Island's history and New England's history. We used to get it. We used to understand you have the job center with the mill, and then you had circumference of houses of all different shapes and sizes around that, and they were either walkable communities or, you know, they were a transit hub where, you know, the horses and or the streetcars or other things came into. So trying to reweave that current zoning in most of those communities doesn't allow that to happen anymore, and so we have to kind of break that down again too, but you know, so what are our current versions of those mills? You know, where are the job centers and how do we build the housing around those centers?
Right. It's, and a lot of states, as you know, have done that. You know, they have a broader plan. So I think I'm encouraged that I think that's going to be really helpful, and there's a commitment to try to do that. I was wondering, speaking of politics, if like any of the people who are running for governor have taken a housing stand.
Mm-hmm.
Are they all aware of kind of some of this data? I haven't heard, so.
Yeah, we regularly send it to all of them when asked, we just send it to everybody. They say, yeah, by the way, happy to talk about it. Most of the major candidates have a housing platform on their for governor on their website. And the governor, and we've participated in the 2030 plan that the current governor has in place that has that housing component on that. So there's definite awareness. And, you know, for the first time in my career in this space, we've got three important things in line. We've always had needs. We've always had, you know, data and resources to demonstrate that need. We on and off have political interest throughout the years on these topics. You know, usually comes in the form of a crisis, a foreclosure crisis, or other things. But for the first time ever, we've got significant money, right, or a significant opportunity for money to come in to actually build and invest. Again, it's millions when I think it's $1 billion-plus problem, but it's a good shot, right? I'm going to take it. So for the first time, those three are aligning. And so that's where I think the opportunity moment is. And you know, we got to keep all those three together and then, more importantly, start to execute and implement some of these thoughts. So we'll see. But I think there's a huge amount of interest. All of the first RIPEC debate, housing was, you know, top of the agenda on questions. So
that's encouraging, too. And so two other quick things. You mentioned the database of, like, housing stock, and then and I actually saw a demo the other day where Bank of America actually has a real estate website that shows housing in, you know, various communities around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we have a down payment program as well you can layer it with
mm-hmm.
other programs. And it was really cool. Like, you could click on the house and see if it was qualified for Bank of America and if it could be qualified. So I don't know if that's helpful.
I'm not familiar with it, so I'd love to see it, though.
Yeah.
You can link me up to your team to take a look at it and see,
okay,
you know, if it's something useful and helpful. I mean, it could be particularly where, you know, when we're talking about a home ownership and how do we, you know, look for opportunities for home ownership, particularly for minority.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Now, I mean, with those numbers not moving, particularly for Blacks and Hispanics, it's been generations of people who have been now let out of, you know, creating some equity and some wealth for their family as well, too. And any rounds that we made, we lost after 2008. So, and the whole foreclosure meltdown and the predatory lending that happened as all part of that. So, you know, again, kind of taking some fresh eyes on that and thinking about that again.
Yeah, we'll get you the link. We're really committed to it, and you know, again, it's a layerable program. We have, and then you can click on the house, and you can see like what it qualifies for and what the income level would be. So it sounded a little bit like what you were talking about. So I'll get you that link.
Yeah, love to look at it.
And the last thing I just wanted to mention too is just with the housing and the health and sports housing. You know, you're probably familiar with PCDC out of New Jersey. They have a lot of data on that. Like the first time I've really ever seen all that data in one place.
Mm-hmm.
Really impressive. And I've heard more and more discussions around hospitals wanting to get involved, you know, given they have their own version of like CRA investments. And we just financed a deal up in Boston that had a layer of financing in it from
mm-hmm.
a hospital. Again, it's beneficial, as you know, keeping people
yeah.
in the emergency room, healthy communities are stronger. So that's an area that we're, you know, looking at,
mm-hmm.
The bank as well, trying to figure out how we can make connections. So I just wanted to put that out there, and I think that's another
yeah.
potential connection and source point.
Yeah, we'd love to talk more about it. We are doing some contractual work with the Rhode Island Department of Health around the HESs and around housing development, but also adding, in partnership with them, adding more health and housing data into the back book as well. The Department of Health has an internal group on housing group across the programmatic, big lead and asthma and climate change and a whole bunch of other programs. They're home visiting programs that kind of touch housing stuff. And so we meet with them regularly to talk about specific action steps or recommendations around action steps. Housing Works also hosts the
Rhode Island Alliance for Healthy Homes, which again tries to bring state agencies across together to talk about this, but also growingly energy programs are very, very interested in the healthy housing space. With Blue Cross and Tufts, we're also in the midst of developing a senior and health and housing action plan as well, too. And so, again, a lot of overlap and health outcomes as part of that as well, too. So, and Tufts, Blue Cross, I think, as you know, invested some significant money into Lyft for a health equity fund. As part of the merger conversations with Rhode Island Foundation, we were very much involved in those conversations about trying to pull in some investments into social determinants and prevention money. Obviously, the merger of the hospital systems didn't happen, but something is going to happen. And so continuing to keep those options alive, you know, as part of what I continue to go to all of this health meetings. Talk about a crazy system, those health systems, you know, trying to figure out that world. I knew the housing system was crazy, but the health system is just as crazy in trying to figure out, you know, the push points there is challenging, but happy to talk more and love to hear more about what Bank of America is doing in that space.
Yeah, and you probably know Megan
Sindel. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Megan
so,
was on Chapman Sports
when
I was there.
Yeah, so she's also just a really great thinker on this, being a
doctor.
Yeah,
we've had her down for Rhode Island a couple of times, but I'd love to get her back so to talk more about this work as well, too. So, and MPEG, as you know, has a healthy housing investment. Conservation Law Foundation is also interested in doing more work in Rhode Island on that front as well, too. So, you know, looking for those opportunities.
I think CBS is involved in that, too, but not in Rhode Island, right?
No. And we've asked.
Yeah. It seemed to be a natural fit.
I agree.
Okay. But I think part of what, you know, having some bigger conversations around this stuff, you know, is part of what I've been talking to Josh and others at the Housing Resources Commission about. This is exactly the kind of conversation we need to have. We need to have, you know, bring in some of those experts around those states and then try some stuff. We're not going to get it right all the time, but so what? I don't care. We've got to keep trying. And we've got to keep experimenting until we do get it right. So, you know, as much as you can kind of be beating that drum and supporting, you know, thinking creatively, thinking differently, and more importantly, thinking about ways to invest this money. I'm sure I've overstepped my time. So.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
Thanks again for the opportunity.
Okay, great. Having no other business, I think
motion to adjourn.
In order.
Second, Ray Berry.
Great. Thank you. Friend, roll call vote, please.
Yes, all those in favor of adjourning this meeting say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The motion carries.
Brenda, thank you for coming in.
Thank you
for your time.
Right, this is great.